Sometimes it happens that some of these mosques, in fact, the place where the mosque, in fact, they stand on, happen to be like on the way, for example, of a road construction or something like that. Yeah. So in that case, if the building of a mosque is removed or destroyed by the municipality of that town or city, should we treat the land of the mosque as part of the mosque? Still, it is considered as mosque or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, if a building, if a mosque is demolished by, let's say, by municipality, of course, and a road crosses through that part of the land of the mosque.
Yes.
That piece of land is no longer considered to be a mosque. It is not treated as mosque,
mm-hmm.
and therefore, it's permissible to make it impure.
Yes.
And if it is made impure, it's not necessary to purify it because it's no longer considered to be mosque. You know, but of course, when it comes to mosques which are dilapidated, which are no longer used, they
deserted,
are in bad
yes.
shape. You know, those buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Which are in ruins, but they used to be mosques in the past.
Yes.
Those places are still considered to be mosques, and of course it's not permissible as an obligatory precaution to make them impure or to let's say, to use them for any other purposes, you know. But when it comes to a demolished mosque, completely demolished,
mm-hmm.
and roads have passed through that place, that place of the mosque or that place where the mosque used to stand is no longer considered to be a mosque.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. What about the third testimony, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, you know, that part of the azan that we always offer, in fact, or say, is it really the part of the azan or a necessary part of the azan or iqama?
Well, there is a consensus among all religious authorities that the third testimony, Ashhadu anna aliyan waliyullah, is not a part of either adhan or iqama, okay? But both the religious authorities, Ayatollah Khamenei and Ayatollah Sistani, have clearly stated that one can recite this zikr with the absolute niyyah, not with the niyyah, not as a part of the adhan or iqama, just as an absolute mustahab zikr.
Mm-hmm.
As an absolute mustahab zikr or recital, it is permissible for a person to recite these two, this zikr or the third testimony in adhan or iqama. And I've seen some scholars deliberately avoiding to recite this zikr in their prayers sometimes, you know. But if a person, you know, considers this zikr or this, testimony as a part, then there is a problem, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because
does that make the prayer void?
No, it doesn't make the prayer void because adhan and iqama are not actually a part of the main
mm-hmm.
body of the prayer, you
yes.
know. These two adhan are said before one starts offering prayer. Aqama is also
but it is attached. The iqama is attached to the prayer.
There can be a gap. For example, when you recite the adhan, you can walk here. You can offer two rakas of prayer. It is recommended actually.
Mm-hmm.
When you recite the adhan, it's recommended to walk two steps or backward or forward,
uh-huh. okay.
and then start offering reciting iqama.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't want to walk stop, then it's recommended to offer two rakas of prayer between adhan and iqama. This
see.
Is what Ayatollah Khamenei has
uh-huh.
expressly and candidly has clearly stated. And then the iqama is there. Iqama, when you finish the iqama, you can still walk around and then start your prayer.
I see.
And the prayer is started by making your niyyah and reciting takbiratul ihram.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because niyyah is the basic element of the prayer. And then takbiratul ihram is the next basic element of the prayer. And the prayer starts with the niyyah.
Okay,
course.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break. Stay with us. Don't go away.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, talking about rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, I wanted to ask you about something that we can hear and see every day in especially Muslim dominated areas, where they broadcast adhan through the loudspeakers of the mosque. What is the Islamic law about this?
Grand Ayatollah Khamenei has said that if the azan is broadcast in the usual conventional manner, just as we see usually, every mosque has loudspeakers, they broadcast the azan through the loudspeakers. This is the conventional method of azan. Azan is meant to inform the people about the timing of the prayer. So there is no problem. Even if we know that there are some people who may not like or may not, who may be disturbed by the azan. Azan has to be said loudly, you know, loudly.
But there is always a volume. Yeah. You can turn it up or down, right?
Yes.
And sometimes the louder speakers are too noisy.
Okay.
Too loud.
The azan is intended to declare the timing, to inform the people to come to the mosque and start praying, offering their congregational prayers or not, or maybe individual prayers. Okay, the time is to be declared, so it has to be the louder it, the voice or the sound, the better it could be.
Yes,
and some, but depending from place to place. Okay,
uh-huh. Okay, but that kind of law I think belongs to the past, because nowadays we have television, we have radio, we have internet, we have, everybody knows, because there is cell phone and you know what the time of the prayer is basically.
You know, this justification or argument is brought up by certain people. And they might justify themselves, you know, in order to, let's say, suppress the azan, the sound of azan, and to stop this tradition, an Islamic tradition, which is one of the signs of a city being Muslim or the people being Muslim. So many people might justify themselves bringing this excuse, okay, we have the clock, we have the mobile phone and everything, and the alarm clock is there, so why do we have to call the azan? I think this justification is out of place, it's misplaced. And but when it comes to, let's say, to broadcasting the recitation of the Quran or in recitation of anything else like that, you see.
What about the recitation of the Quran or other supplications through the loudspeakers? Are they also permissible as the adhan?
Well, that's different, you know. Ayatollah Khamenei has said that, of course, when it comes to the Quran, if it is causing trouble or creating problem for the neighbors, and people are or disturbed by the sound of the recitation, then it's not permissible to use the loudspeaker to broadcast the recitation of the Quran. Especially, you know, we see that in some cities, before the azan starts, you know, for 3 minutes at least, there is the Quran recitation, and then after the recitation, then there is the azan, you know. Ayatollah Khamenei says that, okay, this recitation, that has to be, you know, the sound of the recitation of the Quran should not disturb the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
If it does, then it is not permissible.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun la ilaha illa hu ghaffarun jameelun. سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
In the limelight.
Since 1979, pro-resistance groups in the world's most militarized region have used Iran's Islamic Revolution as a powerful mechanism to mobilize masses against forces that perpetuate various forms of injustice and snatch people's fundamental rights. We have prepared for you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor and blogger who has reported extensively from Kashmir, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan and Iran for leading publications worldwide. The article is titled, How Iran's Islamic Revolution Gained Foothold in Kashmir. Soon after the pro-West puppet regime in Iran was toppled through a popular socio-political movement in 1979, the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, famously declared that the revolution will challenge and decimate arrogant powers across the world. The path-breaking idea was incorporated in the country's constitution, affirming Iran's support for the just struggles of the oppressed people against the oppressors, which later paved the way for a revolutionary movement that took the Muslim world by storm, including in the Indian subcontinent. So what began as a popular nationwide uprising against the hideous plot to westernize Iran transformed into a global movement against despotism, tyranny and hegemonic schemes of the world's arrogant powers. Nations took inspiration from Imam Khomeini's spirited, unwavering resistance to free his country from the clutches of foreign powers who remotely controlled their local minions. Over the past four decades, the movement has gripped the hearts and minds of people everywhere. To invoke the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the Islamic Revolution is akin to the scent of spring flowers, carried by breeze to different corners of the world. In Kashmir, the picturesque Himalayan region, ravaged by decades of conflict, the breezy fragrance feels more strongly 43 years on. The abode of Sufis and saints which embraced Islam in the 14th and 15th century, courtesy of Iranian religious missionaries like Sayyid Sharafuddin Bulbul Shah, Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani and Mir Sayyid Shamsuddin Araqi adopted Imam Khomeini's revolution in letter as well as the spirit. Since 1979, pro-resistance groups in the world's most militarized region have used Iran's Islamic Revolution as a powerful mechanism to mobilize the masses against forces that perpetuate various forms of injustice and snatch people's fundamental rights. The appeal of Imam Khomeini's resistance manual cuts across sectarian lines in the Muslim-majority region, with both Shias and Sunnis crediting him for reinvigorating their struggle for freedom from oppression, subjugation and occupation. Today, the biggest public rallies to mark the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution outside Iran are held in Indian-controlled Kashmir, in places like Srinagar, Budgam, Kargil and more. Around this time of the year, streets in these places are dotted with pictures and banners, paying glowing tribute to Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul and his companions. To put things into perspective, Imam Khomeini had a deep and personal affiliation with Kashmir. The unshakable allegiance of Kashmiris to the ideals of the Islamic Revolution has to be seen in the context of the advocacy of their long-standing political struggle by both Imam Khomeini and his worthy successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Way back in 1965, during a speech in Najaf in Iraq, Imam Khomeini had equated Kashmir with Palestine. He called on Muslims across the globe to lay aside their differences and unite in support of causes like Kashmir and occupied Palestine. That was before all hell broke loose in the contested region in the late 1980s. While the situation turned from bad to worse in the 1990s, Iran's support remained steadfast. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, known for his unequivocal statements, has followed his mentor's roadmap on Kashmir. He has often emphasized the just struggle of the people of Palestine and the people of Kashmir in his sermons and speeches. One of his widely reported statements came on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr in 2017, when he spoke of many wounds inflicted on the body of the Muslim world, singling out Bahrain, Yemen, and Kashmir, and urging Muslims to openly support the people of those countries. After the events of August of 2019, the leader of the Islamic Revolution again called on the Indian government to adopt a just policy towards the noble people of Kashmir and prevent the oppression and bullying of Muslims in this region. The statement was widely welcomed and hailed by the people of Kashmir. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei had, in 1980, just a year after the triumph of the Islamic Revolution, visited Kashmir, when he delivered a historic lecture at Srinagar's Jame Mosque. He also joined congressional prayers led by then Kashmir's chief priest, Mirwais Muhammad Farooq, and visited the residence of Kashmir's then top Shia leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Yusuf Musavi. Imam Khomeini had, through his envoy, conveyed special greetings to Ayatollah Sayyid Yusuf Musavi for his indefatigable efforts in championing the cause of the Islamic Revolution and Islamic revival in Kashmir. Their association dated back to the years when Imam Khomeini was in exile in Iraq. They had exchanged a series of letters discussing important issues. Through Ayatollah Sayyid Yusuf's son, Sayyid Fazlullah Musavi, who was a student in Najaf in Iraq. In one of the letters, Ayatollah Sayyid Yusuf Musavi invited Imam Khomeini to Kashmir, assuring him safety and protection there. According to an account mentioned in the book Tajalliyat by Allama Sayyid Baghir Musavi, during his time in Paris, France, when Imam was asked by a French journalist where he would prefer to go if his asylum was revoked by the French government, his answer was Kashmir. It demonstrated his profound love and trust in Kashmiris. After the 1979 revolution, a stream of religious scholars, diplomats, and political dignitaries traveled to Kashmir. Most notably, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Ayatollah Reza Mahdavi Kani, and others after them. Their visits cemented the historic ties between Iran and Kashmir, also known as Iran-e-Saghir, and further bolstered support for the Islamic Revolution. Today, people in this Himalayan region draw spiritual as well as resistance leadership from the Islamic Republic of Iran. They celebrate the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution every year with great enthusiasm. They continue to see themselves as loyal soldiers of the Islamic Revolution. As a testament to their love and loyalty for Iran and the Islamic Revolution, today we find town squares in Kashmir named after the leaders of the Islamic Revolution, including Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, and Imam Khamenei. We see social and cultural organizations named after the martyrs, like Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari and Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Beheshti. We see youth emulating top general Qasem Soleimani, Mohsen Hojaji, and Ibrahim Hadi, reading and writing about them. After the January of 2020 assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC's Quds Force, and his Iraqi trench mate, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the second-in-command of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, in a US drone strike near Baghdad International Airport, tens of thousands of people took to the streets in Kashmir. They burned the effigies of then-US President Donald Trump and his minions, and reaffirmed their pledge to the sacrosanct ideals of the Islamic Revolution. The same ideals fueled their discontent and anger at the arrogant powers at home. This is the miracle of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, and his illustrious legacy of speaking the truth to power. The legacy that is rooted in history, in the events of Karbala 14 centuries ago.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bafizi, 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 Ey shahidon rahe khuda, Ey karde, bahre ehyay haq jan fada, Kas qatre, قطره خون پاک شما می روید تا ابد در وطن لاله ها برخیزی 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 برخیزی
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tensions between the West and Russia remain high, with the United States and its allies accusing Moscow of planning an invasion on its Western neighbor, Ukraine, and Russia denying all the accusations. The tensions are already starting to hurt Europe, which is largely dependent on Russian gas. The threats of sanctions on Russia are raising fears about a possible disruption of supply and demand in the energy market. There have been other factors at play too. The cold winter, low gas storage levels, high European Union carbon prices, fewer liquefied natural gas tanker deliveries due to higher demand from Asia, lower than normal Russian gas supplies, and infrastructure outages are all cited as reasons why the continent is facing a potential energy crisis.
The crisis which we have is in part self-made by the European Union because they have allowed their storages to run pretty empty in winter time. This is crazy. And there's another story from the EU side, which is unprecedented, I think, in world's history, that there's a double pipeline brand new, ready to deliver on Germany's shores coming directly from Russia. And we are refusing to use that second double pipeline.
That explains rising energy prices across the continent, with benchmark European gas prices at the Dutch TTF hub rising by 330% last year, while benchmark German and French power contracts have more than doubled. The United Kingdom is facing a rise in inflation at rates not seen in the past three decades. A major retail company is now warning that the worst is yet to come. Britain's biggest retailer, Tesco, says the prices of its products can go up to as much as 5% in the months to come. The company blames the matter on the rise in energy bills. Last week, the Bank of England raised interest rates for the second time in 3 months after forecasting that the peak inflation will reach a record 7% in April. What the European countries can't deny is that they need Russian gas. Take Germany, for example, which is expecting the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project to become operational. The pipeline would potentially supply 26 million German households. But the United States might be the one to prevent that from happening.
The notion that Nord Stream 2 would go forward with an invasion by the Russians is just not going to happen.
This is the situation, and it's Europe which is not, you know, trying to make a good connection with Russia and see to it that Nord Stream 2 starts producing, starts delivering. This is the situation. It's a crazy situation. And I think there is no situation like this in human history that the goods are ready, but the victim refuses the goods because there's a stronger guy behind, like Washington, like the US, stopping us.
The US has been warning of what it calls an imminent Russian attack on Ukraine, despite Ukrainian officials' statements that suggest the contrary. Some NATO members are reluctantly backing Washington on this. But the Europeans are the ones who will have to bear the consequences of any conflict or tension on the continent, and not the US. Then, diplomacy and dialogue seem to be the only feasible options between the two sides, as further tensions won't be in anyone's interest.
Israel announced on July 22nd that it had been granted an observer status in the influential African Union after unsuccessful lobbying for nearly 20 years. Since the disbandment of the Organization of African Unity in 2002, Israel had made futile attempts to join the African Union, which replaced the OAU. However, the move was always thwarted by members of the Union, who even called for an end to the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories in February. The crisis was set in motion last July when Moussa Faki Mahamat, chair of the African Union Commission, accepted Israel's accreditation to the 55-member body headquartered in Addis Ababa, triggering a rare dispute within a body that values consensus. Powerful AU member states, notably South Africa and Algeria, quickly spoke out in protest, saying they had not been properly consulted and that the move contradicted numerous AU statements showing their support for the Palestinian territories.
The reason that there are such fierce divisions with regards to the matter of Israel and the African Union, Israel having observer status, is the manner in which Israel became secured its observer status. The decision was taken unilaterally by the African Union head instead of through the consensus procedures that the African Union is accustomed to. In other words, it was forced on the African Union.
In contradiction to his decision just 2 months before accepting Israel's accreditation, Faki himself condemned Israeli bombardments in the Gaza Strip, as well as violent attacks by Israeli security forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds, saying the Israeli army was acting in stark violation of international law. But now Faki has defended his decision, claiming that it could be an instrument in the service of peace. However, Palestinian resistance movements hit back, with Hamas calling on all freedom-loving Africans to voice solidarity with the Palestinian nation and compel Faki to revoke the decision. Hamas said in a statement that reads, "The occupying regime has long practiced state terrorism and systematically commits all kinds of crimes against the Palestinian people, their territories and holy sites. It enacts a policy of ethnic cleansing and racial discrimination as documented by many international human rights organizations." So, how could granting membership or even an observer status to Israel serve as an instrument in the service of peace? While the African Union's main goals are rejecting racism, demanding decolonization, and the right to self-determination. Experts say Israel's observer status is largely seen as part of Tel Aviv's continued campaign to normalize ties in Africa.
When countries expand their ties with Israel, they usually do so in order to get access to Congress or in Washington or the White House. And African countries have been seeking, of course, lobbying access to the Congress and the White House, and believe that ties with Israel helps them.
Back in August, the Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtane Lamamra condemned the decision to grant Israel an observer status at the bloc as a huge mistake. He also chastised the chairman of the AU Commission for defending his decision, saying insistence on the measure will eventually result in the breakup of the regional organization. But what is Tel Aviv after? Israel's AU observer status would pave the way for normalization with African states. In recent years, it has successfully done this with Chad, Sudan, and Morocco. But it's also viewed as an attempt to influence the continent on diplomatic issues. Also, Israel couldn't have normalized ties with these countries without Washington's help. The U.S. used economic or other types of incentives to broker normalization deals between African countries and Israel. For instance, on the same day Sudan signed the U.S.-sponsored deal to normalize ties with Israel, Washington signed a memorandum of understanding with Khartoum to clear $1 billion of the country's arrears to the World Bank. Also, as part of the normalization deal between Morocco and Israel, the U.S. recognized Rabat's sovereignty over Western Sahara, a disputed region claimed by both Morocco and the Algeria-backed Polisario Front.
So the reality here is that there is a recognition that the Palestinian people are continuing to suffer, but political interests, narrow political interests, perhaps naive and very crude political interests, have given rise to this very awkward dilemma for the African Union that threatens, in the words of the Algerian Foreign Minister, to rip apart the African Union if a solution cannot be found to this, the solution being, of course, removing the observer status from Israel.
Israel violates international law as well as international humanitarian law and refuses to implement dozens of resolutions or to abide by recommendations put forward by relevant United Nations committees. Lately, international rights groups have accused the Tel Aviv regime of imposing apartheid on Palestinians. This is while Washington provides the regime with around $3 billion in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions. So, doesn't joining the African Union only prepare the ground for Tel Aviv to spread its evil further? The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has provided some sanctions relief to the countries that had nuclear cooperation with Iran under the terms of the 2015 multilateral agreement. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Friday signed several sanctions waivers related to the 2015 Iran deal, also known as the JCPOA. The waiver covered the conversion of Iran's Arak heavy water reactor, the provision of enriched uranium for its Tehran research reactor, and the transfer of a spent and a scrap reactor fuel abroad. The exemptions allow foreign companies to resume cooperation with Iran on its nuclear projects. The waivers are part of the 2015 accord. They were canceled by former U.S. President Donald Trump after he withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and reimposed anti-Iran sanctions. The latest U.S. move reverses the Trump administration's decision and lifts the sanctions threat against foreign countries and companies from Russia, China, and Europe that had been cooperating with Iran under the terms of the JCPOA. The media cited a U.S. State Department report as saying that the step is meant to facilitate the Vienna talks on the revival of the agreement. Meanwhile, the waiver announcement prompted hawks in Washington to accuse the Biden administration of giving concessions without securing any commitments from Iran. Senator Bob Menendez has asked that the president adopt a tougher position on Iran. He called for new efforts, including creative diplomatic initiatives, stricter sanctions enforcement, and determination from Congress to support President Biden's declaration that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch, something that Iran has repeatedly denied seeking. In addition, these waivers will not entail financial relief to Iran, though there remains a strong case for upfront humanitarian relief as it is the people of Iran who have suffered the most under U.S. sanctions. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are set to resume talks in Vienna. Iran says an agreement hinges on the removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington won't pull out of the deal again. Iran says there have been positive developments in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, but they do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the 2015 nuclear deal hasn't had any economic benefits for Iran in recent years. Amir Abdullahian says Tehran is firmly and explicitly seeking a good deal that would guarantee Iran's economic benefits reliably and sustainably.
I think it is a symbolic pitch. So I think the Joe Biden administration can do better than that, and by starting to lift all the sanctions on the frozen huge amount of money. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars frozen in foreign banks that belong to Iran, and that will be a positive step, not a symbolic step.
A day after the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden restored a sanctions waiver, which was rescinded by his predecessor Donald Trump in May 2020, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Washington must show goodwill on the ground, not on paper. He also said we demanded the guarantee at all political, legal, and economic levels. Agreements have been reached in some areas, but the Iranian negotiating team will seriously pursue getting tangible guarantees from the Western sides that they will abide by their commitments under a Vienna deal. That's in reaction to recent comments by U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, who said Washington cannot guarantee the next administration's adherence to the JCPOA. Iran has time and again stated that one of its main issues is to get the necessary guarantees from the other parties, especially from the West in the Vienna talks.
Well, there is no guarantee for Iran that even Joe Biden, after the signature of this deal that is going to be signed or will be signed and soon, perhaps in the next couple of months, is going to be respected. There are no guarantee that the U.S. is going to respect the deal, and certainly no guarantee that the next administration will abide by it.
Also, Iran's top security official Ali Shamkhani says real, effective, and verifiable economic benefits for Iran are a necessary condition to reach an agreement in Vienna. He said making a pretense of lifting sanctions is not considered to be constructive. He added that Iran has the legal right to continue developing peaceful nuclear capabilities. His comments came as Iran is now awaiting a political decision by the US and European countries for a breakthrough in the sanctions revival talks in Vienna.
Eastern Europe has once again turned into a tinderbox in recent weeks amid a war of words between the United States and its allies on the one side and Russia on the other. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to attack its western neighbor Ukraine, citing thousands of Russian troops stationed along Russia's western borders. The Kremlin, however, has strongly denied the allegation, saying it has deployed the troops as a means of self-defense in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Even Ukraine, a US ally, agrees with Russia on this. Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov has downplayed the threat of an all-out war in Ukraine, blaming the rising tensions on the international media. Also, President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on the West to stop stirring up tensions, arguing that warnings of an imminent invasion are putting Ukraine's economy at risk. Regardless, the US continues to fan the flames of tensions, Washington is now claiming it has information suggesting Moscow will conduct a false flag attack to justify its invasion of Ukraine, but it did not provide any information to back the intelligence findings.
The U.S. captured huge pieces of territory by beating up on Spain, and they used the false flag there, Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. The incubator babies in 1990 was enabled the first war in Iraq. The WMDs, the invisible WMDs in Iraq in 2003. In Libya, the invisible airplanes, apparently Russian satellites just couldn't see them, that were supposedly strafing protesters, that, by the way, no one had any video of in Benghazi and Tripoli, that enabled the bombing and destruction of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. The U.S. does this all the time. Russia, there's no example of that that you can point to, although the State Department spokesperson Ned Price yesterday acted as if there was a long tradition of these actions by the Russians. And so what the U.S. is doing, the simple, the short answer to this is it's called misdirection. Or projection, as a psychiatric term that they use.
It's not the first time the U.S. is making such accusations. Last month, U.S. officials said Russia was preparing to fabricate a pretext for a large-scale operation in Ukraine, an accusation that Moscow slammed as unfounded. China and Russia are strengthening their ties. That's the key takeaway from the meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. It was the first in-person meeting the Chinese president has had with another head of state in about 2 years. Meeting on the sidelines of the Beijing Winter Olympics, the two leaders, in a show of solidarity, stressed that their strategic cooperation was unshakable, warning the West to stop its eastward expansion. The Kremlin said Putin and Xi discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. The announcement comes after U.S. President Joe Biden's threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars as part of sweeping sanctions in the event of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Describing the meeting as warm and substantive, the Kremlin hailed the relationship between the two major powers as an advanced partnership with a special character.
But if China decides that their reciprocal sanctions are going to include we're not selling you any more stuff, then Americans won't have televisions, cars, toasters, refrigerators, all kinds of other things. So the U.S. has been using this as a weapon, but the image I have in my mind as I watch things unfold is of a person that's painting the floor all around them until they end up in the corner by themselves and the rest of the floor wet. They're stuck in the corner.
In a lengthy joint statement, they opposed NATO expansion and accused the U.S. of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. For years, the former Soviet Union and the United States were locked in geopolitical tensions dubbed the Cold War that risked escalating into an all-out war between the two nuclear superpowers. Times have changed since then. The next Cold War could drag on for much longer and prove devastating to all aspects of life on Earth.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Over the past few years, people have become more aware of the detrimental effect of littering on the environment. Now, a Mexican kayaker has decided to launch his own campaign to save the environment. 66-year-old Omar Menchaca usually paddles his single-seater kayak through the floating gardens of the Xochimilco canals near the Mexico City, collecting garbage left by visitors. Menchaca says he normally does the cleanup in the early morning before tourists arrive to the site, using bare hands to pick up debris. The former athlete who did his training for the competitions in the canals says over time he found that the waterways were littered with rubbish. Menchaca believes that if people ignore their environment, soon there will be a time when they have nothing to enjoy. He hopes that his efforts to protect wetlands make a small difference and preserve the place for future generations. The Xochimilco site is home to endemic species, including the critically endangered ones, and is usually visited by thousands of people on weekends.
There are all sorts of peculiar restaurants around the world, but not so many prison-themed eateries. One of them is in the Iranian capital, Tehran, and it is thriving.
The setting is engaging. If we want to suggest it to someone, it's because of the setting too. It's like a cell, both its title and the story of the owners. They wrote here they were inmates themselves and why they were in jail.
Cell 16 serves its customers in cells where they can wear mock prison uniforms. The owners say they got the idea for their diner while they were behind bars for debt. They say they are now open to help newly released inmates who find it hard to get employed and give out part of their proceeds to pay for debt inmates.
There have been several cases where an inmate came and worked here while on leave, and we helped and offered him money to help his problem.
The eatery was opened in 2016. The owners have now expanded their business and own two diners in Tehran and another in the central city of Isfahan. They say they are using their emerging restaurant chain to raise funds to free convicts who are serving time for unpaid debts.
A German man has claimed a new Guinness World Record in hula hooping. Kia Sandmeier set a new record for the longest duration of hula hooping in a plank position. He was able to carry the activity in this difficult pose for over 6 minutes. The 30-year-old says he practiced the plank rigorously in the morning and evenings before and after work. Sandmeier says holding the plank was the most difficult part. The previous record for this activity was set last year by an American with just over 3 minutes. Every year, the Copenhagen Light Festival transformed the winter cold and darkness of the capital city into a celebration of light art in Denmark. In February, the entire city becomes the stage, displaying captivating lighting installations presented by Danish and international artists. The works are planted at more than 30 historical sites, canals, and squares, among other urban spaces. Building facades are also decorated with special lighting designs. The organizers and curators of the festival say the event is important because it gives people a chance to rediscover their own city. Also, the event brings life to a dark season that's normally very quiet by offering joyful experiences for locals and tourists alike.
As the 2022 Winter Olympics have begun in the Chinese capital, Beijing, two playful giant pandas at the Moscow Zoo have come to the spotlight for predicting the outcome of the sports event. On the eve of the Winter Olympics opening, Ru Yi and Ding Ding were each offered 5 traffic cones labeled with national flags of the participating countries, represented by the largest numbers of athletes. The cones that got taken down by them were considered as the winners. The pandas then chose the cones with Chinese and German flags on them. Zoo officials say no treats were placed inside the cones to ensure that the prediction is unbiased. The zoo says it plans to continue the panda prediction for all individual and team competitions at the games. The 15th edition of the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up. As Saman Khujuri reports, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. Here's more.
The 15th Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up its work. The four-day event brought together representatives of different sectors active in tourism and handicrafts fields, including airlines, cruise lines, hotels, museums, travel agencies, insurance services, travel and tourism facilities, and masters of handicrafts. The exhibition is considered as the most appropriate platform to optimize face-to-face communication among the involved industries. From a tourism point of view, Iran enjoys two important and unique features. The first one is Iran's exceptional geographical location among countries in the world, and the second feature is its tourism attractions of historical, cultural, natural pilgrimage, adventurous, and other sorts.
Qalamzani, or metal engraving, is an Iranian ancient metalwork art. It is engraved by chisels and hammers on different metals such as gold, silver, copper, brass, and some alloys. Its origin dates back to almost 7,000 years ago. It is the art of carving superb designs on various metals. The artistic work of this course made by the artists are the glorious and undeniable indication of previous metal work of Iran, and in particular Isfahan.
I'm from Hormozgan province, south of Iran. Handicrafts have always been an integral part of Hormozgan province due to the rich culture and special customs of the region. Hormozgan province embraces scenic islands, among which Kish, Hormoz, Hengam, and Qeshm are the most beautiful ones and top tourist destinations in southern Iran.
Iran has globally registered 11 cities and 3 villages under their native handicrafts during the past 6 years, making the country a world leader in registering local productions. There are totally 602 handicrafts fields identified on a global scale. 299 fields are special to Iran, from which 199 fields are in the central Iranian province of Isfahan.
With 14 entries, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council, as China with 7 entries, Chile with 4 entries, and India with 3 ones come next. Saman Khujuri, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A joyous festive mood in East Asia as the region welcomes the Lunar New Year with celebrations, including light and lantern decorations of homes and public avenues. People across China are staging a variety of events to mark the New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. Several cities have held breathtaking light shows, with many landmarks and skyscrapers dazzling with colorful images. In the capital, Beijing, the light shows feature elements of the Winter Olympics as the city is getting ready to host the International Games this week. Elsewhere, Malaysians welcome the Year of the Tiger with an underwater lion dance performance in an aquarium in the capital, Kuala Lumpur. The citizens have welcomed the return of the annual event, which had been called off the previous year due to COVID-19 restrictions.
A lot happier as compared to during the lockdown period where you're alone and you do things alone. You feel very lonely, right? Now that you get to be in touch with your family, yeah, it's a lot better.
Even though we still keep the social distance, but however, I feel the freedom to go out and visit and do the things that I like to do.
Celebrations are also underway in Hong Kong, Taiwan and Indonesia. The Lunar New Year, seen as a time of reunion and rebirth, is celebrated by more than 2 billion people worldwide, especially amongst Asian communities. The festivities last for over a fortnight.
Stunning light shows and hanging lanterns have illuminated cities across China to welcome the new Lunar Year, also called the Spring Festival. The city of Zigong has taken the spotlight with a sea of lanterns, turning it into a scene straight out of a fairy tale. The city is famous for lantern making and brings a festive mood this time around every year. The lanterns are usually made in all kinds and shapes, including legendary creatures representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, which is decorated vividly on special couplets. The New Year festivities officially begin on Tuesday and will continue for 15 days. The Lunar New Year is considered the largest migration of people in the world, as millions travel back to their towns and villages to mark the event.
Sub-zero temperatures in the Midwestern U.S. haven't held anglers back from participating in the world's largest charitable ice fishing contest. Some 10,000 people from across the world gathered in the state of Minnesota to put their ice fishing skills to test. They dug thousands of holes in Gull Lake in a matter of hours. Some $200,000 in prizes were up for grabs in the contest. The volunteer-led annual event has so far raised about $4 million for 67 charities since it was first held in 1991. Beryl Carr is a special volunteer at a hospital in London. What makes her special, you might wonder? Well, the fact that she celebrated her 100th birthday last month. Carr has been volunteering in Ealing Hospital for more than 18 years. She works in the hospital's cafe and says her work is her lifeline. This incredible 100-year-old lady says she enjoys helping those who are not as fortunate as she is and that she has no intentions of retiring. The hospital staff say her presence has been very motivating.
Many of us look at her. She's always got a smile on her face, a swagger as she walks. And you come back from a clinic or a ward round, you're absolutely tired, and she just inspires you as soon as you see her.
Even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped Carr from volunteering. Born in a nearby town, Carr says she moved back to the neighborhood more than two decades ago after the death of her husband. When asked about the secret to her long and healthy life, she refused to answer, saying she's not planning on revealing that secret. A surprise in a Chinese zoo ahead of the Lunar New Year. 15 rare golden tigers make debut in front of excited fans. A large group of visitors gathered in China's Yellow River Delta Zoo to watch the rare animals. This zoo is the largest breeding base for golden species of tigers across China. The animals are being strictly protected amid fears surrounding their extinction. The golden tigers are a variant of Bengali tigers with rare color variations, including black strips. They are no longer extant in the wild.
The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately a million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope.
Are IRIB English Radio.